from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, we learned that a planet 500 light years away is in the Goldilocks zone for life. Not too hot, not too cold, maybe with water, a lot like Earth. Stand by. And much closer to home, there's big buzz over a moon of Saturn, an ocean within, and more life talk there. This hour On Point, new discoveries, new hope for finding life in outer space. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen the picture of our Earth twin way out there, Kepler-186f? Heard the news of geysers, maybe an ocean on the moon of Saturn? Do you hope for life in space? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Sometimes action and feedback takes a long time in these space programs. Here's the nighttime launch of the Cassini spacecraft from Cape Canaveral, October 15th, 1997. Last few weeks, its findings very much in the news. Here's a video way back then from an excited spectator posted on YouTube.
Get ready, baby.
Four,
get this.
Research, news from Cassini, and more in the news this week. We're going to look at it. Joining me now from Boulder, Colorado, is Carolyn Porco, leader of the imaging science team on NASA's Cassini mission. Cassini was launched there in 97 to observe Saturn and now orbits the planet, collecting images and data. She's also director of Cyclops, the Cassini Imaging Central Laboratory for Operations at the Space Science Institute in Boulder, Colorado. Carolyn Porco, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Tom.
And with us from Mountain View, California, is Chris McKay, senior scientist at the Space Science and Astrobiology Division at NASA's Ames Research Center. His research focuses on the evolution of the solar system and the origin of life. Chris McKay, thank you so much for being with us.
You bet. My pleasure, Tom.
We've got a lot to say today about what we are learning from the Cassini mission and a very particular moon of Saturn that looks like it has an ocean inside. We'll talk about that. But the news just in the last 24 hours, and Chris, let me come first to you on this, is of a planet much further from Earth, 500 light years away, we're told, that from the images that I and I guess everybody else is seeing in the last 24 hours, looks incredibly like Earth. You just glimpse it and you see what looks like oceans and land masses and cloud cover. It's said to be just 10% larger than Earth. Chris, what can you tell us about how we've learned about this rather distant planet, though still in our galaxy, and why there's so much excitement about it?
Well, this planet was discovered by the Kepler spacecraft, whose job has been to detect planets. It's done a wonderful scientific job. It detects planets by watching them move in front of their star. So what we really see is the shadow of this planet as it moves in front of a star. And from that, we can determine the size of the planet and its distance from the star. And in some fundamental way, those are the parameters that determine whether a planet could be a place for water and hence for life. So we know that this planet has got the right stuff in the sense that it's got the right size and it's at the right distance from its star for water to be liquid on the surface if there's water there. But we don't really know what the planet looks like. What we know is how big it is and how far it is from its star. But it fits the bill. This could be a habitable world.
Okay, I want to talk about that, but Carolyn, help us here, because space scientists, in their eagerness to communicate with the big public, color up images. I mean, I saw very explicit looking, what looked like a photograph last night on the news, sitting next to Earth with what looked like, you know, it could be almost a South America floating there on what looked like it could almost be an ocean. Is that just an artist's rendering, Carolyn?
Yes, that is. And you know, it's important that we do that to give the public an impression of what it is we think is out there. So, you know, everybody should read the fine print when
yes.
they see the news and they see pictures like that. But, you know, let me just emphasize, this is such an exciting discovery that the Kepler mission has made and the Kepler scientists have made going through all the reams of data that they have. And it's the first really definitive observation of an Earth size and very likely Earth-like planet in the habitable zone of a star. And this has kind of like been the golden fleece, or sorry, the golden chalice that people have been, the Holy Grail is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, yes.
That scientists have been after. You know, it's the first step. We know now there's a planet like this. And even though I'm not sure that our instruments at the moment are capable of answering the question that Chris just alluded to. Is there liquid water on the surface? Mm-hmm. Could there possibly be oxygen in its atmosphere if it has one? Those are going to be the next kinds of questions we're going to be asking. But it's really a banner day in the search for Earth-like planets.
It looks like an Earth twin, this Goldilocks quality, not too hot, not too cold, maybe with water and something like Earth. How rare is that, Chris? If this is the first one we've found, does that suggest it's extremely rare out in the observable universe?
No, quite the contrary, Tom. It suggests that it's extremely common.
Because we've looked so little compared to the vastness?
Well, because Kepler is only looking at a tiny part of the sky. And if the few stars, only a couple hundred thousand, that Kepler's looking at, contains Earth-like planets, then that means that there are literally millions and millions of them in the galaxy. So the fact that we see one where we look so far, Kepler may discover more, means that there's a lot of them when you factor in the huge number of stars in the galaxy. So what it's telling us is there are a lot of houses in this neighborhood, or the neighborhood's the galaxy. We don't know if anybody's living in them, but we know there's lots of houses.
Which raises the odds that there could be somebody, some sort of life living in them. You're an astrobiologist, so you've got a stake in this that is, in a way, it's almost theoretical, but we're talking 500 light years away. That's trillions and trillions and trillions of miles. If there's life and it's that far away, it's cool to imagine, maybe cool one to even know. What does it matter, Chris?
Well, it matters in a couple ways. First, it gives us a challenge to look more deeply. As Carolyn said, we can't tell if there's oxygen in the atmosphere. That'd be a challenge for future telescopes. Mm-hmm. Could we zoom in on this planet and detect oxygen in its atmosphere? That would be really exciting. So it gives us a technological challenge.
But we're not going to shake hands with this life form or have a picnic with them. Aren't they like almost eternally unreachable for humans?
Well, the SETI folks have immediately started looking at this planet. Maybe there's someone there sending signals. Maybe they're not as unreachable as we think. If they're only microscopic life, then it'll be a long, long time before we can investigate its biochemistry. In terms of those kind of questions, it's our solar system that we're going to be confined to for a while.
Let's bring it back to the solar system for a minute, if we may, Carolyn. I know you have got this Cassini mission, and Chris is paying close attention here, too, around Saturn. I'll come back to that big issue, but take us to this beautiful moon of Saturn. This one is being illustrated as a kind of gumball with a cold crust and this luscious ocean inside. Where is it? What is it, Carolyn, and why the excitement on the moon of Saturn front?
Well, I just would like to comment first on what you guys just said. It's important to know that there's life elsewhere in the galaxy, and therefore in the universe, because it enriches our concept of ourselves and the universe in which we live. And that's important for the human soul. It may not put bread on the table, but it is part of our progress and intellectual development. Getting back to Enceladus is not within the rings of Saturn. It's a moon about the size of the United Kingdom. And at its south pole is this unique geological province from which we found early on in the mission, already 10 years ago or 9 years ago, geysers, erupting from the south pole. And we've been studying this geological terrain and the material coming out of the geysers and so on with the Cassini mission. We've been taking the spacecraft and barnstorming through this plume of material, scooping up material, measuring its composition. In my group here in Boulder, just 200 feet away from where I am right now, we've been surveying to find these geysers, know where they're coming from. And over the last 9 years, we have suspected that there was an ocean underneath the South Pole from which these geysers erupted. And in this recent announcement, one other team on the Cassini mission has confirmed there is an ocean. So So that is another just tremendous excitement now that we know for sure there's liquid water under the surface. The geysers are coming from them. They are laced with organic compounds. They have all the hallmarks of an extraterrestrial habitable zone, not of the type you were discussing in orbit around a star. And this is not surface water. There's a whole other class of possible habitable zones that are underneath ice shells in the moons in our solar system. So the whole idea of where life could be has just, you know, blown its cover. It could be so many places, and we're very excited about Enceladus because its habitable zone is accessible. It's close to us. We could go there and study it. It's not completely crazy to think it's snowing microbes at the South Pole of Enceladus.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about life out there in space, maybe in an ocean, on a moon of Saturn, maybe on an Earth twin 500 light years away. Carolyn Porco is with us from Boulder, Colorado, leader of the imaging science team on the Cassini mission, launched in 97, now orbiting Saturn, and exciting observations, and what more coming back just nonstop lately from Saturn and its moon. Chris McKay is with us from Mountain View, California, senior scientist at the Space Science and Astrobiology Division at NASA Ames Research Center, paying a lot of attention to this moon, Enceladus, as well. Cassini launched in 97. Here's the sound in 2005 of the probe Huygens descending from Cassini, approaching Saturn's moon Titan, where it successfully landed in January 2005. Just a little sound of static there from around Saturn. The big talk this time is around Enceladus. Of course, all kinds of excited thinking about where life might be. 2013 film Europa Report was about an international crew of astronauts' fictional search for life on Jupiter's moon, Europa.
I would hope we keep looking for the answers to those really tough questions. Who are we? Where do we come from? And are we alone?
Are we alone? Maybe not. Carolyn Porco, you were saying before the break that we now have confirmation of an ocean within this kind of icy gumball of a moon, Enceladus, around Saturn. How does one go about confirming the existence of an ocean we can't see, we can't touch? What's led to this assertion, this claim that there's an ocean in there? What's the science?
Okay, so one of the things that you can do when you have a spacecraft flying by a body in the solar system, well, of course, we're tracking these spacecraft all the time. We have to remain in communication with them. We have to know where they are. And if you make everything else go quiet on the spacecraft and you just track the signals coming from the spacecraft, you can determine how fast it's going, the direction it's going in, and you can also determine any departures from the prediction of where it should be. And from that, you can get a measure of how strong the gravitational influence is of the body it's flying by on the spacecraft. Well, with Cassini, they flew in one of these quiet modes. They flew Cassini by Enceladus in three separate flybys of this nature. They put all the information together, and they were able to determine the distribution of mass within the body. And they could tell that at the South Pole, there had to be, in order to interpret the signals possible, there had to be a lens of liquid water under an ice shell that's about 35 kilometers thick. So that's, I guess, about 25 miles thick or something on that order.
Okay.
And the ocean itself is about, let's say, 6 miles thick. So, I mean, to know that is just was like just a great, like I said, a confirmation that what we had suspected all these 9 years was really correct. So it's like we could check off that box, and we're moving on now. We're moving on to thinking about, okay, we have an ocean, we have organic materials, we have a great, great promise that this could be a really interesting place where if life doesn't exist now, the processes leading up to life might be going on. And so Chris and I are both on a mission, on a team that's planning a mission to return to Enceladus to bring back a sample of its plume to Earth-based laboratories for study.
So you're going to find the life and bring it home if it's out there. Maybe let me ask this, Chris, organic materials. How do we know there's organic material in this ocean inside Enceladus? If indeed it's there, the proof seems to be that it is.
That's correct, Tom. As the Cassini spacecraft flew through the plume, it directly measured the contents of the plume. And in addition to finding water, of course, it found organic material. So I like to call it a soup. It's got organics, it's got ammonia, it's got everything a microbe would want to have. So it's habitable. That ocean, the material coming out of it, is habitable. And we can fly right through the plume and collect it. It's almost like there's a sign in space there that says, free samples from a habitable ocean. Take one.
This is incredible. I'm hearing this described as a body of water about the size of Lake Superior. This is a very icy-looking moon. It is an icy moon. Why isn't it frozen to the core, Chris?
Well, as it goes around Saturn, tidal forces squeeze it and release it, and those tidal forces pump energy into the moon, and somehow that energy is enough to keep it warm. We can't exactly make the equations balance out, so we're not sure if the energy is enough to keep it going or if the energy produces episodic eruptions, but we know that there's liquid. We know there's geysers. Probably the liquid has been there for a very long time because once it froze solid, the liquid might not ever come back. So the liquid is probably a long-term feature of Enceladus. The plumes may come and go. They may only persist for a million years and then be gone for some millions of years.
If there's life in there, you're the astrobiologist. What kind of life would this environment suggest it might be?
Well, based on our experience on Earth, which is only a data point of one, based on that experience, we'd expect microbes that like to live in slightly salty water and like to eat organic material. Any of a number of organisms could fit that bill. So many, many things on Earth, many of the microbes on Earth would be happy to live in that ocean.
But we're not talking plankton, squid, leaping fish. That's not what you're envisioning.
We don't think so. On Earth, those took literally billions of years before they evolved. And so we don't think that that's going to happen on another world, particularly if it's not oxygen-rich like the Earth is. But you know, I want to remind you that we're basing this only on the example of Earth. That's one example. Life could be a lot more clever and diverse than we appreciate. So we'll go looking for microbes. But if there's things more complicated, we should be prepared to be surprised.
Let me get a call here from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Richard is calling. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Well, hello.
Hi.
Nice to be able to talk to you.
You too.
I have a question for your expert there, and I've given this considerable thought over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've wondered if someone had actually made a calculation as to the probability of finding Earth and finding life anywhere else but Earth. When I think about everything that comes together to make life possible on Earth, the magnetic field, the distance from the sun.
Yes, yes.
I suppose there must be a good 20, 30 factors that if you tweak just one, just a little bit, it would pretty much leave Earth barren. So,
Richard, let me ask you. I'll put that to my guest. Let me ask you though. If we're talking just about microbes, not about wildebeests and zebras and humans, can you picture it on a moon of Saturn? Some very simple life form.
Right, and I think that's an important. I mean, life is life.
Quite right. Let me take this question of odds to my guests, and I appreciate your call, Richard. Chris, how about it? Do you lay odds as an astrobiologist? Are you saying a 50-50 chance or 90% likely, or do you go there?
This is a very important question, and we discuss it often. We do look at the history of the Earth, and there are lots of twists and turns. And, of course, another planet wouldn't exactly reproduce the conditions on Earth. But that doesn't mean that that planet wouldn't be suitable for life. And as you alluded to, Tom, microbial life might be much more robust than complex large animals and like us. So it's hard to predict. And the real point is I think we need to be somewhat humble about how much we can deduce when we have only one data point, and that's Earth. We don't know what's specific and unique to Earth and what is a general property of light. So, for example, the magnetic field. Yeah, life on Earth uses the magnetic field. It has shielded the Earth. There are times during Earth history when there's no magnetic field. We're not sure that a magnetic field is required for life. Maybe not even for complex life, much less microbial life. I think the best way to approach mm-hmm. this question mm-hmm. is to go search.
Let me put you on the spot. What do you think are the odds there are life on Enceladus, the moon of Saturn we're talking about?
I think the odds there are certainly in the high enough to warrant going and searching for it. So I wouldn't be prepared to say that it's 50-50, but I'd say it certainly warrants going, getting a sample, and searching for life in it.
Okay, let me get one more call.
Can I comment on this?
Yes, of course, Carolyn. I think you're unstoppable on Enceladus.
Mara and I know I'm incorrigible. The word here, there's two words with regard to Enceladus. Mm-hmm. One is its habitable zone is accessible to us, easily accessible. You don't have to dig. You don't have to scratch. You don't have to worry about intense radiation fields. You just fly through the plume.
Because of these geysers.
Because of the plume, mm-hmm. and we know it comes from
the
ocean.
It's sort of huffing and puffing out whatever's inside is the presumption here.
Right, but let me point out to you something that's been highlighted in the Cosmos series that's going on mm-hmm. right now, hosted by Neil deGrasse Tyson,
yes.
that there's a microbe, I didn't even know about it until this show, called the tardigrade. And this tardigrade, they claim, is about the size of the head of a pin. And it is robust. It could be in outer space, you know, without mm-hmm. A habitable zone anywhere, and it could survive. So we know there are microbes that could survive really extreme conditions, which says more, even more, that we should expect to be surprised when we go searching in another habitable zone. And Chris is right. What we need to do is get more data points to understand.
Big push to go out there and do that. Mark in Boston, thanks for calling, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was really excited when I heard this news. I know that if you look back through human history, usually when you have a new objective, whether it's a new continent across the ocean or whether it's going to the moon or whether it's solving any particular challenge that comes up, it tends to be a gigantic spur for new technology and new scientific understanding and new understanding of anything that goes into what you're examining. So when you have possibly a planet that might host life or might be able to host life, in this era when technology is developing so rapidly, I can't even begin to imagine what sort of things might be developed as we try to understand what's going on with extraterrestrial life on possibly that moon or possibly this planet. I know that we obviously don't have the technology to travel to that other planet yet, but I guess I was wondering from your guests, What sort of technological developments do you think might be both necessary in order to really capitalize on these discoveries,
yes.
and also might be possible?
Those are great questions. Let's put Kepler-186f aside for a moment, 500 light years away. That's very tall science. But if we could look at Enceladus and the moon there, Carolyn, in terms of this mission that you and Chris would like to see take place to go and what is it exactly you want to do? Fly more directly into the geyser, capture material there, bring it back to Earth? What's the dream?
Well, the dream is just to go the next step. I mean, the big dream, of course, is land a spacecraft, get up, you know, close and personal with the ocean itself. But the next step, the dream, is to send scientific instruments to Enceladus that are far more capable than the ones that are on Cassini now.
To do what?
To determine the chemical composition of the plume and to see if there are any biomarkers there. And I'm really at this point going to turn this over to Chris because he should answer this question. He knows the real answers.
Great. Chris, do you want to find the life and bring it home? Is that the idea?
That's right. But as Carolyn indicated, we'd also want to do some more analysis of the plume while we're there. And mm-hmm. in particular, I'd like to search for amino acids. Those are the building blocks of proteins. We know that they're found in comets and meteorites. We know that life uses them. If there's life in Enceladus, it's probably also using amino acids. So we'd search for them while we're there, and we'd bring a sample back to test for test for life on Earth. And that's, in fact, the challenge. Your listener was talking about the technology we need to develop. Well, one technology we need to develop is a way to bring back a sample from a place that might have life in a way that's safe, that's contained, where we don't have – where we have zero risk of releasing that sample in Earth's environment without control. So that's a challenge that we're studying right now, how to safely collect a sample from a place that could have life, that may have life in the sample, and bring it back to Earth in a way that's rigorous in the control.
What's the risk of a potential release into Earth atmosphere of a life form from Enceladus?
Well, it's probably minimal. Most likely it would just die, and then that would be unfortunate from a science point of view. But we don't know. And so the precautionary principle mandates that we be very, very conservative and have zero chance of it being released into the environment. And that's dictated by international law as well. So NASA takes
the concern there
seriously,
being that it could be a threat to Earth life, the kudzu from space here that sort of crawls all over or sickens.
Exactly. You never know. And we just don't want to take that chance.
So how would you do that? How do you get it back and study it without it – with zero risk? That's a very high bar of it getting loose.
Right. Well, I think what you do is first when you collect it, you contain it very tightly. So you – and you make sure that the outside of the container has – is no longer in contact with the plume, so-called break the chain of contact. That's the key step. The second key step is you bring it back to Earth in a fail-safe system. And I think that means, for example, you don't use a parachute. Parachutes may not deploy. Parachutes may get carried with the wind in ways you don't understand. You just come straight back like a bullet so that you know exactly what it's doing and where it's going, and you design it to survive the impact. So you do a completely different design.
You mean it can come like a bullet to land on Earth and not smash up and break open?
Exactly. You design it that way from the start.
Is that possible to survive that kind of impact?
We think so. A small capsule, we're not bringing very much back. A small capsule can be designed that way, and you eliminate any sort of process on the entry system. It's just coming straight in. You know exactly what it's going to do. It's coming in like a meteorite, and small meteorites can land on the surface of the Earth without being disrupted. So we're working on designs to do that.
Amazing.
These aren't technologies we have in hand.
Have you pictured that moment when somebody brings you the capsule that's been brought back from it, somehow it didn't blow to smithereens, and they carry it into your lab, and here in this vial, this indestructible vial, is life from an icy moon's liquid center?
Yep. I'm there.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life out there in space, maybe in an ocean on a moon of Saturn, maybe on an Earth twin 500 light years away. Carolyn Porco joins us. She's leader of the imaging science team on the Cassini mission. It's been orbiting Saturn, sending back some pretty exciting detail about the moon Enceladus, where it's believed now there's an ocean inside. Geysers pumping out plumes. She's with us from Boulder, Colorado. Chris McKay is here from Mountain View, California. He's senior scientist at the Space Science and Astrobiology Division at NASA's Ames Research Center. They would both like to see another another probe out to Enceladus, the moon, for us to learn more about the possibility, a very real one, they say, of life there. Mark in Wilmington, Massachusetts, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wonder about bringing a sample back, if it can potentially be brought back via the Mir space station, or perhaps even at some point in the future, if there's a moon station, that it can stop there first before coming back to Earth, and that way we can determine whether it's safe or not.
Great idea. Chris, what about it? A stop off at a space station, either orbiting or on the moon, before we bring it here?
That's certainly something to consider. You can imagine bringing a sample back and either bringing it to the space station or having it stay in orbit and then astronauts go up and get it and have them escort it back. There's a general perception, I think correctly, that that would be the safest way to bring it back. But within the NASA system, that's mixing human activities, human exploration activities with the robotic program, something that we can do, but it's not always easy for just reasons of bureaucracy.
Carolyn, push your imagination further ahead. What about a probe into this moon ocean itself. Is that imaginable? Is it doable with current technology? Can you picture the technology that might make that possible, some sort of probe to the interior?
I think I'm pushing my imagination here, but I don't think I have to push it too far because there have been mission designs that have been studied where you take basically a hot probe that's working off the heat difference between something hot and the ice, and you could just have it melt through to get to the ocean. Now, on Enceladus, this is really easy because there's already fractures from which issue these geysers. So we know that there are weak zones in the ice shell, and in fact, it's not out of the question. In fact, it's likely that the water table, even though there's an ocean 25 miles below, there's the water table could be only a few kilometers within a few kilometers of the surface, and it's not out of the question that some of the water actually can bubble up to be near the surface. So if you want to get near the water, you don't have to go too far, and you could thermally push down with a probe and get to it. So that's doable. It just takes resources. It takes political will. And it's not clear we're going to have that in the near term, but who knows, maybe in the future.
We know science has its own tribes and its own enthusiasms. There are people who have been enthusiastic for a while now about going to the moon Europa, about going to the moon Titan. Other moons, not this one. What about the comparative desirability of these trips, Chris? Is it clear that Enceladus is the place we should go? If we had other guests, would they have other targets in the solar system?
Sure, and on different days, I have different targets. I like all those targets you mentioned, Tom. Europa,
Moon
Titan,
Jupiter,
are both very interesting worlds. There's a process of developing the logic behind each target and considering missions and their costs and the trade-offs. And the community's pretty good about converging on this kind of decision. But what we're doing for Enceladus is a necessary part, which is making the case. Here's a really interesting world, recently discovered properties. Let's understand what's going on. And then at some point, let's look at all the options out there, look at the resources, and decide what to move forward. I think what's happening with Enceladus is it's emerging into competition, so to speak. So Europa held the sway for a long time in the outer solar system because that's the one we learned about first. Then Titan came in and made a strong show with the early results from Cassini. And now coming from the background is Enceladus, coming up and edging ahead maybe. So it's a horse race kind of, and we'll see how it goes. And the decision will be made by the whole planetary science community in a process that's pretty well developed.
Carolyn, this may not be your expertise exactly, but push your imagination even further, because we are, with the Kepler 186F, 500 light years away, the possibility of a kind of Earth twin out there in the Goldilocks zone. What about that? How do we ever confirm whether or not there's life on a planet so far away? Or will, you know, in the even deep time distance from humans, will that always be a matter of conjecture?
Well, I believe that the hallmark of life will be the presence of free oxygen. Chris can correct me if I'm wrong. He's the astrobiologist. But I think that would be the thing people would get enormously excited about if they could see that there was oxygen, because oxygen in our atmosphere was really the result of photosynthesis. So,
is there a hope of detecting that from 500 light years?
If the instruments, the telescopes, and so on got big enough, good enough, sensitive enough to be able to detect a spectroscopic signature in this little blip going across the surface, you know, in appearance, just crossing its star. And I don't really think that's out of the question. I just think the sensitivity and so on has to be pushed. So detecting whether or not there's free oxygen in the atmosphere of a planet, I don't think I have to push my imagination too far to get to that point. I think, you know, in some number of decades in the future, that will be possible, and that will be very exciting.
Chris, our astrobiologist, there's Kepler 186F way out there. Will it always be a matter of speculation, of likelihood, or its opposite, that there's life there? Or at that distance, could we ever know?
Well, I think Carolyn got it right. The next step is to search for oxygen. But, and the
but,
discovery
but,
of
but do we have capacity to do that at this distance?
Oh, yeah, we do.
How?
We do. We've got to build a telescope. We know how to do it. It's just a matter of doing it. I think Carolyn said decades. I think one decade. I think in 10 years we could know whether there's oxygen in 186F. And if it's there at high levels like the Earth, it would be very, very exciting. And that would be presumptive evidence of life, not just of life, but the capability for complex life. Because on Earth, as oxygen rose up, life got more complex. So the rise of multicellular organisms, tardigrades, the small animals that Carolyn was talking about, they start appearing on Earth when oxygen appears. So finding oxygen is really very, very important. It's hard to overemphasize the importance of finding high oxygen levels on another world.
And we could detect it even from a distance like this.
We could. With a big space interferometer, we could take a spectrum of that world and determine, does it have oxygen? Now that Kepler told us where it is, we know where the house is. Now we can look through the windows.
Amazing.
See,
amazing.
Is there anything inside? Oxygen is the key.
Let me get a call from Toivola, Michigan. Nona is calling. Hi, Nona. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Yeah. I just have a comment about that. I mean, it's just so wonderful that they have found, you know, this stuff in outer space, but I find it odd that we don't even know about Mother Earth. We don't know what you mentioned, Lake Superior, earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody has even checked out the bottom of that, and let alone our beautiful oceans. And we lost a Malaysian aircraft.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I mean, they're able to traffic spaceships going to the into outer space, and they can't find something on our own beautiful Earth.
No, I hear you, Nona. It seems that there may be incongruities here that we may simply have to embrace. I mean, Carolyn, it's just the irony that we can't find an airplane in our own ocean, but you're suggesting we'll find life on Enceladus, a moon of Saturn.
Well, there's different goals, different technologies, and different challenges to doing either one. And you know, you got to also, I hate to say this, I hate the P word, but there's always politics behind these things and where the governments choose to put their resources. I'm with Nona in that I am horrified at what we're doing to our own planet. I'm going to put a little bit of environmental activism in here.
Okay.
I'm horrified at what we are doing to our oceans. Our oceans have become soups of plastic.
Sheesh.
And I'm horrified that we it's continuing, and it would be enormous amounts of resources and efforts to clean it up. And yet we could detect oxygen on a planet 500 light years away. It is incongruous, but, it all comes down to political will.
Carolyn Porco, we love your enthusiasm for this and your capacity to make it happen. We hope that you find the resources to push ahead with that. And we're so grateful to you for joining us today from Boulder, Colorado, and the imaging science team on the Cassini mission. Carolyn, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me and giving me the opportunity to go wild about Enceladus.
Great. I get a call right here. Dylan in Greenwood, South Carolina. Dylan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is really about, your experts are talking about how we have to find planets with oxygen and we're really looking for amino acids and stuff. But how might we have to redefine our concept of life a little bit in order to truly understand the discoveries that can potentially be made?
I love the question. Chris McKay, how about it? How flexible can we imagine being in terms of what would qualify as life, what we would recognize?
That's a wonderful question. And right now, of course, we're searching for life like us, liquid water, amino acids, things that we feel at home.
I mean, even if only in microbial scale.
Yeah, exactly. It would be wonderful to find life that's living in a different liquid, like on Titan, living in liquid methane, or living with a different chemistry, not amino acids.
Would we know it if we saw it? Would we understand what we were looking at?
Yeah, that's a challenge. I hope we would. Life has a tendency to do things in its environment that makes it obvious. So hopefully we would see that. We've already thought about what life on Titan would do if it was there, how it would leave a signature in its environment the way life does on Earth. And so it's possible that we'd find it. And I would love to be in a position where we've got to broaden our definition of life because we're being faced with different types of life forms. Right now we're searching for what we know. We hope to find what we don't know.
talk about mind expanding, that would sort of be the definition of mind expansion, expanding our understanding of what life itself can be. Chris McKay, stand by in Mountain View, California. Scientists have discovered another object in Saturn's rings, news of it this week, which may be a new moon forming there, giving us an insight into Saturn's other icy moons. With us now from London is Carl Murray, professor of mathematics and astronomy at Queen Mary University in London. He was lead author of a report this week about the icy object in Saturn's rings, which has been nicknamed Peggy. We've been talking about Enceladus. Carl Murray, you're talking about Peggy. What are you suggesting is Peggy, Carl?
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
We're not really sure. What we do know is that about a year ago we saw, purely by accident, a bright object right at the edge of Saturn's main ring. And we immediately started looking at old images, started replanning new images to make sure we captured it if at all possible. And we've been kind of keeping track of it now for just over a year. And it may be a small icy moon in the making, and it kind of seems outlandish, but we believe, according to recent theories, that the icy satellites of Saturn actually formed in the rings when the rings were much larger and escaped and migrated outwards. So that's kind of the excitement of this object.
When does a cluster of ice become considered an actual moon, an icy moon? What's the difference between, you know, a bunch of stuff sort of orbiting in proximity and an actual moon?
Well, I would say, first of all, it has to get clear of the rings. We have a couple of real moons, or moonlets, if you like, embedded in the rings that have cleared gaps for themselves. But this is kind of something different in the sense that we know there are other objects in the rings, not quite moon-sized or moonlet-sized, but this we think is sort of a kilometer, maybe a half a mile in diameter, and literally perhaps just caught in the act of escaping. So once it's kind of free-floating, if you like, and out there on its own, and we can get a good orbit for it, then we can give it a proper name and study it in detail. But the intriguing bit at the moment is studying how it's interacting with the ring material from which it may be kind of escaping. Because going back to your theme about life elsewhere in the solar system, mm-hmm. and just the wonderful discoveries of Kepler, we need to know how planets form. And if you like, the rings of Saturn are like a miniature solar system. The whole Saturn system is like a miniature solar system, and we believe planets formed out of disks of material and migrated once they formed because of their interactions with the disk. And so looking at something as small as this object and seeing how it evolves and interacts with its surroundings, it's actually telling us something about how planets form and then ultimately how life can form.
We may be looking at the birth of Peggy, a little tiny moon of Saturn. Amazing. Things always changing out there. Chris McKay, does that mean that we could still be creating new zones of potential life, or I guess it does. Things change.
Right. That's to me the fundamental message of this of the results regarding Peggy is that the solar system is still changing. We tend to think of it as a static beauty that was put in place billions of years ago, and it's frozen and it's just going in orbits with precise regularity, and nothing is new. But this shows us that, indeed, that's not the case, that there is change, that there is dynamics, that things are happening. And from an astrobiology point of view, this is exciting. It says that environments can be changing, situations are changing, stuff is being created, stuff is being destroyed. And that opens up opportunities to think in different ways about the possibilities of life. So change is good.
Chris, you want to find life in Enceladus, the moon, and bring it back to Earth and study it. What about going the other way? Can you picture, are we ever going to send up a scuba diving astronaut to swim in the interior of this marvelous moon off Saturn? Can you picture that 100, 1,000 years from now?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to imagine that. I've done diving in ice-covered lakes in Antarctica, and there we only go through a few meters of ice. It's pretty tough just doing that. I imagine swimming down a couple kilometers, that would be a challenge. But maybe someday there'll be people that will think of that extreme sport as something they want to do. So tourism in the outer solar system, hey, it might happen. Get your bags packed and be ready to go.
Yeah. A mind-expanding hour, and we are grateful for it. Carl Murray at Queen Mary University of London, thank you so much for joining us today, Carl, telling us about Peggy. And Chris McKay at the NASA Ames Research Center, astrobiologist there in Mountain View, California. Chris, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
What a wonder. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.